does have it all. All of our pre-owned vehicles are Hubler Q certified, which include a 128-point vehicle inspection, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and two warranties. A two-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and a 30-day, 1,000-mile comprehensive warranty. Visit any of our 13 locations today, or click drivehubler.com. Hubler has it all.
Eddie Gale joins us now on the program. Pacers and the Milwaukee Bucks getting set for the NBA playoffs. They will play game number one a week from yesterday, so that's this upcoming Sunday. Eddie, I'm going to get to the tough challenge right away. Giannis's last name, you pronounce it how?
Antetokounmpo.
One more time?
Antetokounmpo.
It's going with you.
Yep. Sounds close to me.
Jimmy's going with you. All right. Jeremiah and I go with the Adetokounmpo, but I think it's kind of tomato tomato, right? It really, that's why everybody calls him Giannis.
It took a long time for me to be able to say what I just said, so I'm going with that.
Fair enough. Hey, before we get to Eddie, the Pacers in the playoffs, because it's still within the same family, I want to get your thought on this. I think we're on the precipice here of a major, like, certainly like a pop cultural phenom coming to Indianapolis in Caitlin Clark tonight, hearing her name called in 7 hours, most likely. I say it that way to protect you because, you know, it's not official the Fever are going to take her, but I think we all know that that's going to happen. What will it mean for, in particular, young girls, but basketball fans in general? I don't know that people that are on the outside realize just how big this is going to be, or am I overselling it?
No, I don't think you are. I think it's a tremendous opportunity for the women's basketball as a whole. I thought Dawn Staley was right on the button when she had her post-game interview after winning the national championship, and what Caitlin Clark has been able to do for women's basketball over the last couple seasons. Now, with that said, you know, that she's had some help with the Angel Reese's of the world and those. But Caitlin Clark, in her own right, has just phenomenal basketball player and what she's been able to do. But for the city of Indianapolis, I think it's going to be huge for women's basketball and be able to continue to grow the sport. I have a daughter who played high school basketball and collegiate basketball, and to be able to have young girls seeing those types of players out there and see a little bit of that in themselves and things they can aspire to be. In which they haven't really had that opportunity. And I think social media and TV has really heightened some of that stuff. We've seen great players come before, but it's now gone to another level with the access and visibility. You got to give that a lot of credit as well. So I think it's going to be huge for the city. And yes, you're right. She definitely has all of the markings and indications of a outright celebrity in any industry.
Okay, Eddie, yesterday at the game, you know, there was obviously that talk, especially once the game was over, knowing that the WNBA draft was coming and then Caitlin Clark being on Saturday Night Live. So you had kind of this crossover of that excitement and then the Pacers' excitement as well with the playoffs. We're at the game yesterday. Afterwards, I immediately go home. I'm watching the end of the New York game, and that ended up in such that the Pacers end up with the Milwaukee Bucks. I know in the regular season, advantage Indiana, but thoughts now on postseason, do we in any way, shape, or form rely on what we saw in the regular season between these two teams?
I think it gives you an opportunity to be cautiously optimistic, right? Over the last couple seasons, the Bucks have really had their way with the Pacers, and where we saw them on the schedule, and it just was not a good night for the Pacers on most of those nights. But this season, they've definitely flipped that and turned it on its head, in large part due to the acquisitions that the Pacers have been able to make over the last couple seasons. And then also, I think the Bucks took a step backwards to some degree. As phenomenal as Damian Lillard is, and we know that I'm a little bit partial to Weber State, so give them a shout out. But they took a step back defensively when you lose guys like Drew Holiday, Javon Carter. I believe they missed one more big time defender to go along. Obviously, Giannis is one of the best players in the game. But defensively, that tells you all you need to know about how important it is to really win and win at a high level, contend for championships and that kind of thing. They obviously went through a coaching change in the middle of the season. So they're a team that's in flux and trying to figure it out. But having said that, I think they're still a very good team. It's going to be a very good series. So to think that, you know, we're going to go in and sweep them because we won 4 out of 5 games is probably not the most rational thought.
Eddie Gill of the Pacers Radio Network in Bally Sports Indiana taking some time with us. Eddie, the Pacers were able to control that season series and get the real bragging rights in the in-season tournament, but all of that was done prior to the arrival of Pascal Siakam. Now, of course, the Pacers changed in a lot of other ways since then in terms of, you know, no longer having Buddy Hield in the mix or Bruce Brown in the mix for that matter, both being traded away this year. What is Pascal Siakam's injection do to this series as a whole as he gets a taste of the Bucks for the first time as a member of the Pacers?
I mean, I think that was a huge move for the Pacers. It really elevated the responsibility and expectations of this team. They were already had improved before the trade, but when you inject a two-time All-Star, a guy who's been playing the way he's been playing, playing All-Star basketball, All-Star caliber basketball since he joined the Pacers, now all of a sudden you're not thinking about getting to the playoffs. You're thinking about getting there and advancing once you add him to the fold. Because he's a guy, you don't necessarily need to call a play for him. He can just go get it on his own. He draws a double team. He makes the right plays out of that. He's efficient. He doesn't need 25 shots to get 25. And he just causes so many different problems for the team. And on top of that, he gets on the other end, sits down in the stand, and he guards. So I love the addition of Pascal Siakam. I like what he brings and like the 1-2 punch with obviously him and Tyrese Halliburton. And Miles Turner has been kind of the guy who hasn't been spoken about, in my opinion, enough based on his stability. And he played, I want to say, 72 or 70-something games again this season. So he's been really good. But just overall, going back to that trade, I thought it was a great move for the Pacers. And, hopefully we can hang on to him.
Eddie, some of the greatest aspects of Pacers postseason basketball have been the theater that's been involved in these matchups. You think about Reggie Miller versus Spike Lee in New York. You think about the back and forth between Paul George, David West, Roy Hibbert, and those Miami Heat teams. And you saw a little bit of potentially a budding rivalry in different areas, but one area I want to focus on is the back and forth between Tyrese Halliburton and Damian Lillard. How much showmanship between both those two guards while experiencing these playoff moments and trying to get wins for their teams? How big of a storyline is the back and forth between those two heavyweights going to be?
Man, I think it's huge. I love it. I mean, first of all, I just love the game and love it in general. I watch it nightly, regardless of whether it's NBA or college basketball. But when you have these types of storylines in it, and trash talking is somewhat of a thing that's a thing of the past. So when you see a little bit of it and games get a little bit chippy and guys are heating up a little bit, that's what I'm here for, all of it. So while I'll be trying to call it and that kind of thing, I'll have a box of popcorn at the same time with all the entertainment that's surrounding it, because I'm sure Damian Lillard will not forget when Tyrese Halliburton hit that shot and looked down at his wrist. And the Pacers will not forget when Malik Beasley said, when we see them in the playoffs, something to the effect of, when we see them in the playoffs, it will not be good. So a lot of chalkboard material for both teams, and that's what playoff basketball is about.
Who is the biggest trash talker that you played against?
I've been around Gary Payton, and this is when I very first came into the league, and he'll trash talk about anything. So so he's probably one of the biggest ones out there. Kobe was a big one back in the day, obviously, also probably earlier on in my career. I just feel like it was more of the norm. Or maybe because I was on the court, you could hear more and you're participating in it. It just doesn't seem as much as though as I see as much of it nowadays.
Okay, here we go. How about this one? Who's the guy that you played with, Eddie Gill, that had the greatest disparity between how much trash talking he could have done but actually was completely quiet, reserved, and never really said much but just let his game do the talking?
That's a good one. I'd probably say Jason Kidd.
Really?
Jason Kidd. Yeah, Jason Kidd. We obviously understand how good he was as a player and been good as a coach now, but he was all, one of the top point guards that the game has seen, and especially during his time, I feel like he didn't talk as much as he probably should have been.
Eddie Gill is our guest. Yeah, he probably could have. I mean, listen, he was – things ran through Jason Kidd for sure, no question about it, right? Eddie Gill, our guest. Bally Sports is where you see him on television doing games pre- and post-game, and then, of course, on the radio network with Mark Boyle as well, Pacers and Bucks set for the playoffs. Eddie, I've always felt like, and you tell me if I'm wrong here, but in covering playoff series, the things to me that always were fascinating, especially in a seven-game series, which they all are now, is that the series, like the storylines would change like every two games, and teams would kind of chess match one another and have to counter and punch back, etc. How many different styles does this Indiana team have that Rick Carlisle can work with? I asked this earlier in the last week to somebody, but do you feel like Carlisle is going to say, this is who we are, we're going to push all in, and you try to beat that? Or does this roster give him flexibility of different looks throughout the course of a series?
I kind of think they'll be true to who they are. They've been a top two offense throughout the entire season for the most part. And it's in large part due to the pace of play that they played, the random style of play that they have. There's few play calls out there. There are some, but there's few out there. But just being able to have Tyrese Halliburton at the point, he makes so many great decisions in transition when they're pushing the basketball up off of makes or misses. T.J. McConnell comes in the game. They play a similar style, similar brand. You have to just – some of it is read and reacting concepts that they have out there and less play calling, although there's some of them. Now, having said that, inevitably every single playoffs that we've seen this, the game slows down to some degree because defenses are much better. You have to play against some half-court defense and figure out a way to execute in that capacity. So you'll see them probably inject some more sets for those types of instances. But again, I go back to Pascal Siakam and his ability to attract a double team in a half-court set, freeing up guys on the perimeter to knock down shots or cutters going to the basket. So I think they have the ability to do both now with when you insert Pascal Siakam because he's so good in the post. And then also when he rebounds the ball and he can get from end to end on his own. But overall, I do think that they'll stay true to themselves and just continue to try to improve as they have in the latter part of the season on the defensive end.
Eddie Gill of Bally Sports and the Pacers Radio Network with us. Eddie, the play-in tournament's been around for 4 years now, and I think it's undoubtedly true that it has changed, at least in terms of the value and the late-season push you see from teams on the outside looking in that otherwise would have been non-existent. I personally think it's been good for the league. But I also think that there are teams that feel like that they are better or above the play-in tournament in terms of the way they're structured, and they definitely want to avoid it at all costs. Do you feel like that was a motivating factor for the Pacers this season? And is there any sense of relief you feel at the fact they were able to avoid the play-in tournament?
It is a significant motivating factor, in my estimation, as you look at you almost, especially if you're in that 9-10 game, because you almost now you're in the NCAA tournament. It's win or that's it, or it's 1-2-3 Cancun type of deal. 7-8, now you get two games to prove it or get in, but it's still a lot of anxiety and a lot of stress for those teams, understanding that the season could be over in one or two games. And to that end, for the Pacers, I think it definitely applies. Having missed the playoffs the last few seasons and taking a gigantic step in the right direction. Last season even missed the play-in. So this is a huge step in the right direction. Now you can focus on an opponent, focus on a seven-game series, and really your chances to advance versus, we got to have it all riding on this one game. And this has been a season like I don't know if we've seen this before. I even mentioned to JJ before the game. I don't know. I can't recall a season going into the last game of the season where so much was on the line for so many different teams throughout the entire league.
Which is by design, right?
Yeah, no question. Adam Silver does it again. From a fan perspective, it's got to be great.
Eddie, when you were playing, Eddie Gill is our guest. When you were a player, were you a part of any teams? And my apologies for not knowing this off the top of my head, but were you a part of any teams where there was a major mid-season trade?
Major mid-season. I would probably say while I was in Portland, it was the year Rasheed Wallace was traded.
Okay. So when that happens, I ask it for your perspective on it. When that happens and you have a mid-season major trade of the personnel, how long realistically do you think it takes for a team – to then be back to all cylinders? And do you feel like the Pacers now with Siakam has that transformation 100% taken place now?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of nuance that goes to it, but I think it's dependent upon your system and the guys that you have there, young, old, IQs, you know, coaching staff, those types of things. But overall, it probably takes a couple months to get it acclimated. And I think the biggest adjustment is really on the defensive end versus the offensive end, unless you're a team that's running a set every single time down the court, which we know that in today's game, that's not a thing. Back in the day, there was a lot of sets being run, but today's game isn't as much, especially if you're looking at a team like the Pacers, where they talked about it earlier. They play a more of a random style type of game, and Pascal Siakam, for example, being the veteran that he is, and his style of play just fits in well. But I do believe the biggest adjustment is on the defensive end in terms of strategies, calls, verbiage, who's a good defender, who's a okay defender, who's a bad defender, all those types of things. So I think, but just overall, a month or two between a team being able to really just say, hey, we're ready, and there's no more adjustments needed. And as far as how it pertains to the Pacers, I think they're definitely in that place as Siakam has been here long enough.
It goes without saying, Eddie, that Miles Turner is important to this team, and that Tyrese Haliburton playing at a high level and then Siakam are important. I think we could safely say that's probably the three most critical elements for Indiana. But every series we like to talk about quote-unquote X factors. Give me a guy on the Pacers roster that you look at and you say, if that guy plays at, you know, balls out in this series, then that's going to be absolutely critical for the Pacers. And a guy that you may not think of but is really important to their success is who?
Yeah, they have about four of those guys. But if you made me pick one, I'm going to say Nesmith. I'm going to say Nesmith in large part for what he does defensively, the amount of different positions that he guards at a really high level, his shot making, while, you know, as you referenced, if it's Haliburton making a play, if Siakam's making a play, if Turner has a game, if he has a game going and he's getting extra attention, I believe it's got to be Nesmith to have a big series and just a good playoff run. I think he will. I got nothing but confidence in what he's been able to do throughout this season. And I think him staying out of foul trouble is going to be incredibly important because he's going to be relied on to. He's going to get some Giannis. He'll get some Dame. He will. You know. He'll get some Middleton. He's a guy who's going to be guarding all three of those guys at some point throughout the series. And if he's able to stay on the floor and slow those guys, or at least just make it difficult, you know, because they're going to be out there a lot. So, you know, he can't guard all three of them at the same time. That's when you think about Nembhard as well and what he's going to be able to do with that lineup. But overall, if you made me pick one guy, I'd say Nesmith.
Okay, you will be doing – and I always forget, so my apologies, Eddie. I know that, like, TV contracts get weird with the playoffs. You're doing TV stuff and radio, or just radio stuff with Mark for the playoffs?
I believe a combination of the two.
Okay. Well, we will – look forward to it, the coverage on both television and radio, Bally Sports with Jeremiah Johnson, and then, of course, on radio with Mark Boyle as well, Eddie Gill joining us. Eddie, appreciate it, and we look forward to talking to you, hopefully, for another series, right?
Yes, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you guys for having me.
I appreciate it. Eddie Gill joining us on the program.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Mike Chappell is the dean of writers and covers of the Indianapolis Colts. He has been doing so. Matter of fact, he helped him unload the Mayflower. Did you know that, Jimmy?
I had read about that, but I wasn't sure if it was folklore or if it was true. I'm glad to know it was indeed factual. Thank you for
letting
me know that.
He did drive one of them. There were like six. They went in different directions. Nobody knew which way they were going so that you didn't know where they were going to end up. But it was Indianapolis where they did end up. Mike joins us now from CBS 4 and WXIN Fox 59.
You realize that's what they call alternative facts, don't you? I mean, that's or a lie.
There were only four trucks. Sorry.
Yeah, the people in Beach Grove were complaining because I had a Mayflower, you know, van outside my house for like 3 days. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
That's right. Actually, you know what, Mike? So those days you were in Anderson, right?
Correct.
You know, we've never actually gone over this, and we'll get to DeForest Buckner here in a second, but it is kind of a fun topic. I mean, I remember because we just had the 40th anniversary of that move recently, And one of the more fun interviews I've ever done was a guy that was a student at University of Maryland, and they were sitting around in the fraternity house one day, and somebody came in and said, hey, who wants to work for, you know, $15 an hour for 5 hours loading up trucks? And so he went and did it, and he said, guys, we're stealing shoulder pads and sweatshirts and everything else. But and that is true, isn't it, that they loaded up the Mayflower trucks and then sent them – each truck went into a different direction as to kind of throw off the scent where they, exactly they were heading. But you were on the receiving end of it. You were here in Indy when the trucks rolled in. Was it one of those things where nobody really, like, I'll believe it when they actually are on 465 type thing?
Well, people need to realize Indy wasn't the first choice at all.
Yeah,
all signs pointing to Phoenix. I mean, they thought they had it done. And then maybe Jacksonville to a lesser degree. But when it came time to when it came clear that Baltimore was doing the eminent domain, they said, "Okay, we're gone." And I think it'd be amazing, and I've talked to some people about it, how quickly you can get out of town when the posse's coming. And they weren't about to let the legislature have a chance that next morning of claiming the franchise. So. You know, it's give and take, and you know who was right, who was wrong, and all that stuff. But they did what at the time they felt the gun was at their head. And if we don't leave tonight, we won't have the option to leave tomorrow. So yeah, and it, again, personally, I was still the sports editor, or I had been sports editor to Anderson. Maybe I still was. God, that's a second life ago. And for 10 years. And it just so happened that I came to the Star that summer, and I helped John Banch cover the Colts for the first several years because I was still in Anderson, you know, physically, and it just made sense. And then, you know, and then here I am all these years later. But no, it was – and again, I was still in Anderson because I was covering the Hoosier Dome that day that Bob Irsay and Hud and all those guys walked into the stadium, and God, there were thousands of people there. So yeah, it's really kind of cool to think back that far. But no, you're right, they got all these because you had to load everything, whatever, you know, whatever you could carry, get out of there, because when the vans left, you were gone.
Chap, there are stories of people that worked for the Colts that when they got to Indy, like, there was a box with their name on it, and it was like, well, here's your desk. I mean, like, this is – we just went in and threw everything into a box and put, you know, Mike Chappell on it, and boom, and there you go, right. And there's your photos and whatever else. You know, the other thing that I've always found, and I've mentioned this on the air a dozen times, but it fascinates me. If you go to Crown Hill Cemetery, where Bob Irsay's final resting place, and, you know, Bob Irsay couldn't be entombed in Baltimore, obviously, although he never lived there. He lived in Chicago, but he's buried at Crown Hill. And if you are standing at Jim or at Bob Irsay's tomb with the big horseshoe, and you look straight ahead, literally 12 feet away, Chap, do you know whose resting place is right across from Bob Irsay's?
No.
The CEO of Mayflower Moving Trucks.
Is that right?
Yeah. Right across the way. And I think Mayflower, I don't think you could get a Mayflower moving truck in the state of Maryland now. Honestly. I think that might have sealed their fate. From a business standpoint, but nonetheless.
And it was one where somebody, whether it was Hudnut or somebody, David Frick, somebody, they knew the guy, the Mayflower guy, was a neighbor or whatever. Everything came together. And I remember talking when we did one of these anniversary things. I talked to the guy. I can't think of his name. I'm getting, you know, I have trouble remembering my grandkids' names. Johnson, I don't know. I'd butcher it. But everything just came together. And again, you're right. A lot of guys. Rick Venturi is really good on this. The people who were going to come with the team, they knew at the last minute where Jim Irsay said, "Hey, let's get." And there were some employees who didn't know.
Johnny B. Smith is his name.
That's it. Yeah. But there were some employees who went to bed that night thinking, "Okay, I guess I got to get up in the morning and go to work," and they didn't know that they didn't have a job the next day. So it was. And it's how it had to be, and I realize it's a burr in the saddle of the Colts fans, of the Baltimore Colts fans, but, you know, it was business at the highest level, and if that is your business, that is your family business, you do what you can to protect it, and if the city of Baltimore doesn't like it, then, you know, they should have done more to keep the team.
It was a burr in the saddle for Baltimore fans until all of a sudden one day people in Cleveland were driving to work and it was like, by the way, don't go to work if you work for the Browns.
I say that all the time as, you know, you'll never get over it, but you got to get past it. And you guys stole Cleveland's team, for crying out loud. Now, the difference is the league made Cleveland leave all the name and everything, all the records and all
that
stuff.
That's it. Yeah, that's it.
Would that have changed things? Maybe. You know, because it is still, whenever we put that this guy set a record and it's, you know, he surpassed Bobby Boyd, he surpassed somebody.
Yeah, Raymond Berry.
That is the main difference. And I understand that, but you know, you guys stole the city's team too. And by the way, you're firmly entrenched. You won Super Bowl. So yeah, get past it and move on, for crying out loud.
Mike Chappell is our guest, CBS 4 and WXIN Fox 59, where you can read and see his coverage of the Colts. All right, Chapp, let's get to it. DeForest Buckner, 2-year extension. I think $46 million is the number that I saw. Obviously, well worth the investment. He's been a pro's pro for the Colts. But what does that mean, if anything, just in terms of cap structure, room? Was it a surprise?
Oh, not a surprise. I on our podcast on CBS 4 and Fox 59, we've been saying that, you know, all these things are done. There's not a chance Buck's going to go anywhere. He would have been a free agent at the end of the year. And this guy is, if you say, what kind of player do we like? Person, player, you know, all this stuff. It's DeForest Buckner. And he's just now 30. I like the fact that it's a 2-year extension. It's not one of those 5 years, although you can walk away from any contract. But it's 2 years. He signed through 2026. And I'm right now getting a story done. Is they've got like 21 players signed through 26. That's a bunch. I mean, that's in today's NFL, where rosters change at a drop of a hat. They have kind of focused, these are our core players. Now, some of those 20, a good portion of those 20 are recent draft picks. So they're under contract. But when you do Pittman, you do Moore, you do Grover Stewart, and Tyquan Lewis is only 2 years, but Zaire Franklin and now Buck, and of course you get the quarterback. That's, if you like this team now, you're going to like it. You're going to need to like it in 26, because these guys, in large part, will still be here. I think the significant guys who need extensions now, next offseason, are Ryan Kelly and maybe E.J. Speed. I saw, it's funny, we were at the Colts Complex sometime last week. It may have been the Chuck Strong thing, but I'm pulling up, and Ryan Kelly's out, and he's playing golf on that par three, those, what is it, two or three holes that they've got out there.
Yep.
So I just stopped and talked to him for a while. I said, so you're not retired, huh? Because there was all that stuff last year about him retiring that really pissed him off. But he said, no, he said, having a good time. I like to play golf. And I said, well, you know, how much longer are you going to do this? He said, well, he said, you know, 10 years sounds good. This will be year 9. So I wouldn't be surprised. Maybe they let his contract play out and then address it. Remember they did this with Costanzo. He played 10 years. He signed a 2-year extension and only played the 1 year. So and Kelly, it was a setting where Kelly's not going to be BSing me. So he wants to play another 2 years, at least this year and next year, which if he does next year, that's going to require an extension. But these guys, and I realize it riles up the fan base because they're bringing the gang back. Well, that's fine, but this gang hasn't won a playoff game, you know, since Andrew Luck was here, I guess, wasn't it? Yeah, it was in 18. So the bottom line is they've got to be right on Anthony Richardson, or all this stuff doesn't really matter. You'll be recycling quarterbacks again, and that gets you absolutely nowhere. So if they're right on Anthony Richardson, then this is not a bad roster. It still needs a starting corner. It still needs another explosive receiver. You know, a tight end would be nice. Who Brock Bowers would really be nice, but I just don't see him being there at 15, and I certainly don't see Ballard moving up in round 1. So I like the roster, but I only like it if the quarterback works, and if that's the case, then they've got a chance this year.
The Dean, Mike Chappell of Fox 59 and CBS 4, taking some time with us. Chap, how do you, with so much money tied into internal players, with what, $200 million doled out as it was?
$239 million with these guys.
There you go. $239 million in house for the Colts in terms of re-signing and retaining guys. How do you fairly evaluate the hits and misses in regards to the effectiveness of Chris Ballard doing his job?
Well, part of it early on was the quarterback, and you know, with Luck in town Friday, which was really, it was really cool getting caught up with Andrew Luck. This guy is, he's happy. So good for him. Good for him. And then, by the way, he also earned about $109 million in his career. So good for him on several fronts. But at some point, you can't use the Andrew Luck is no longer here crutch. You've got to have replaced him. They haven't, which to me skewers so much of what they've done. Because when you miss on the quarterback, like I said, it just paralyzes you. By and large, I like what they've done. Their misses, you know, Shaq Leonard. You know, was it wrong to do him when they did? Well, no, because he was on a perennial all-pro course and, you know, Hall of Fame. Well, that's down the road. But and then the back injury. And as we all said at the time, when you're dealing with backs, you just don't know. And now he may – will he play again? I don't know. But, you know, if you're going to re-sign your own, the Quentin Nelsons and Braden Smiths and Pittman and all the Kenny Moore's gotten two extensions. Grover's gotten two contracts, and Zaire's gotten two contracts after their rookie deal. So I wish they would have gone out and gotten a veteran free agent. I do. Daniel Hunter would have been nice if they would have been able to get him, keep him from going to Houston. What it would have taken, I don't know. They, you know, everything I've been told, they offered more than Houston did. Maybe the guaranteed money they weren't willing to go to, I don't know. Or maybe Hunter just wanted to go back home to Houston. So overall good, but again, good's not good enough when you're not making the playoffs. And they just haven't gotten over the hump because of the quarterback. I just, that's what it is, and that's on them. That's on them that they put their faith in Carson Wentz, and they put their faith in Phillip Rivers thinking you were going to get more than 1 year. And then the Matt Ryan thing that just blew up on him. And then it's just crazy that the best investment they've made at quarterback since Ballard's been here, the most effective, was Gardner Minshew, which is crazy. I personally think he's going to crash and burn in Vegas, but that's not the point. He got him within two or three plays of winning, not making the playoffs, of winning the AFC South last year. He did. With all of his warts and all that, he still did. You know, he certainly overachieved.
Well, Chap, did he not kind of create a baseline for what we would expect? And look, to his credit, he played well, right, Minshew? But did that not give you a baseline of, okay, so that means that if Anthony Richardson can even just a little bit of a tick be a better or more versatile quarterback, then you got to like where they stand, right?
No question. But yeah, and we're putting that blind faith, which is sort of what it is, in a guy that's played four games in the NFL. And if you look at his 173 snaps, he played what amounted to three games, four starts, three games, because he missed a half of two of his starts. He missed a half of two of the starts. So, and again, I liked what I saw in the small sample size, but gosh, you just don't know. But you're right. You're right. At the very least, you know, if Gardner Minshew can get them there, and don't you think that if, just by what you saw, and I realize we're projecting, but if Anthony Richardson is the quarterback for 15 games last year, don't they win a couple more games? You think they convert? Don't they convert fourth and two against Houston with AR at quarterback? Maybe they beat Cleveland, although the points weren't the problem against Cleveland and New Orleans. And so, yeah, but that's why I say that's what everything they seem to be doing is with, hey, we got Richardson back. He was special when he was in there. And again, I add a second thing. I add Jonathan Taylor. He played essentially eight games last year of you know, really Jonathan Taylor football. He played 11, but remember the Tennessee game he played sparingly. Then he had an injury later on. So they're really, really banking on those two offensive players lifting everyone else up around them. Now, defensively, I don't know. You know, they still need a starting corner so bad. I would still sign a veteran safety, and maybe they will. There are safeties out there, and they can make that work, you know, a year, $6 million, whatever. I don't know. They can get that done. But, no, that's if the quarterback and Jonathan Taylor worked, this is a better team because Richardson will be better if you're right, and Taylor will be better. So, and the guys they re-signed, they didn't re-sign, you know, a 33-year-old player. They signed guys who are just about that at that point of their career, but all these were semi-short contracts, the 2- and 3-year contracts and extensions. So, yeah, but having said all that, I understand people saying this approach hasn't worked. What have you gotten out of this? You've gotten, you know, no playoff wins, and in December you're, well, if you do this, you do that. I understand that, and it's really impossible to cut into that argument because Mike, it's true. So we'll see if this works. It's not worked to this point. We'll see if it works now.
Mike Chappell of Fox 9 and CBS 4 joins us. Mike, when I look at all these mock drafts, I keep seeing Brock Bauer's name. I think that'd be a great fit. I like the idea of Shane Steichen finally having a tight end that is do-it-all, that will develop into a high-level tight end versus 3 or 4 that do things really well. But I also don't buy that he's actually going to be there. So let's take him off the board and say that he's already gone. I would still be doing all that I can to supply the young quarterback with weapons. We're just over 10 days out. We're getting into serious time now in draft prep. Where do you ultimately think they go if it comes down to offensive weapon versus defensive weapon? Both have high merits of argument for real needs for this team.
I'm with you. I would go receiver, then corner, because I want the quarterback to have every positive option to help him succeed. Because, again, this won't be his rookie season, but it'll be darn close. Experience-wise, so he needs the receiver room needs a player. It needs a shock player. Although you're probably, I think maybe what their rationale is going to be is they can get a really good starting corner at 15 or trade back, you know, 5 spots and still get that corner. And the receiver draft is deep enough to get a receiver in the second round, which probably is true. I would rather know that I'm getting potentially a difference maker at receiver, and how do you say make do? That's not what they need to think about. But and then get a corner in round two. Although you look at the roster, the biggest need from forget how you look. The biggest need's a corner. You need a corner more than you need another receiver. But it's close. I just would err. Go back to, you know, the Pullian years, and it's similar only in that you've got the quarterback, you know, who you believe in. Man, they spent pick after pick after pick, early picks on skill, Edgerton and Dallas Clark and all these guys, and you know, Reggie Wayne, Joe Addai, Anthony Gonzalez. Yeah, I would go offense just because, you know, now maybe that means you need to score 30 a game. I don't know. But I saw what Steichen did last year with that group, and they were like 10th in scoring. I'm thinking, holy smokes, what if you gave him Brock Bowers? What if you gave him a receiver who can come up and really stretch the field and all that? So, but my heart says – get a receiver and then a corner, but my head tells me they're going to do it the other way around and get that corner with that first round pick.
Mike Chappell, our guest. Chappell, let's go back to the Andrew Luck appearance at the Chuck Strong Gathering, which is, of course, the annual fundraiser for leukemia research in honor of Chuck Pagano. And Andrew Luck was there, and that was the first time that he really sat down and just opened up. You know, what were kind of the takeaways, I guess, in terms of how did he look physically? You know, at one point he had lost a lot of weight. I mean, does he look like he's in quote-unquote playing shape? And just overall summarize for people that may not have seen or heard the mood of Luck's appearance.
He's not in playing shape. I'm not one of those guys that can go to the state fair and guess weights. He played at what, 230? He's not that. But he looked good. He looked in really good shape. But it was just his disposition and his how he talked. He was the same way, where he's always smiling and giving you the yuck stuff and all that. But it's clear that he really likes where he is right now. He's got, you know, the wife Nicole, who we made it very clear that she's very busy with the Olympics coming up. She's heavily involved in the gymnastics scene. But he's got, you know, Lucy, the daughter, I think she's 4 now. Penelope's 20 months. He enjoys being a dad. He's either gotten his master's or is getting his master's from Stanford in, I think, education. I think it is.
That's right, yeah.
And he's going around. Pagano mentioned that Luck just got back from, like, Japan. He did a football clinic or whatever in Japan. And I think Luck just is something of an ambassador for the game. He coaches, I think he said, 2 days a week at Palo Alto High School. He's probably quarterback's coach or whatever. And he made it very clear that he wants or needs, whatever the word is, football in his life. He said it's just got to be different. It can't be playing. Because I did ask him, I said, in the 5 or 6 years since you left, have you ever had that itch to where, man, I could concentrate on 6 months, get myself in shape and play? And he said no. He said never. He said that part of his football life ended that late night in the early morning at Lucas Oil Stadium. He knew. But he just needs football in his life at some level, whether it's coaching, you know, the old pay it forward thing, to where he got his, and now he just feels the responsibility of sharing. And I can't imagine anybody to be a better coach than Andrew Luck. I think he would be demanding, but I don't think he would be one of those guys that says, no, I did this. Why can't you do this? Why can't you make this? Or I think he'd be very, very disciplined, and he could connect with these young kids on how to play the game, what's important. So the bottom line, he's in a very, very good place, and good for him. And it's funny, we would post things Friday about this, or when I did my story, and the fact that there's still hate comments is incredible.
Mike, listen, I've always said this. It's very easy for guys, and I understand it, the people that are like, he turned his back on his team. He quit on his team. I get it, right? I'll tell you what. I've said it before. I'll say it again. Oftentimes, loyalty is defined by your lack of options. But more so than that, I've been laid off in my career, Mike. I've been laid off 3 times in my career, right?
Yep.
All 3 times that I got laid off, I found out 5 minutes before I got laid off. They didn't come to me and ask me what would be a good time to lay me off, right?
Yeah.
They didn't come to me and say, what would be the most convenient for you? So, you know what? Like, when a decision was made and it was in their best interest to move on from me, I respect it. I get it. And that's what happened. And you know what? The same thing, the shoe was on the other foot. And he got to a point where he was like, I just can't do this anymore mentally. And okay. And he did it the exact same way that teams do when they cut a guy.
But that's the one of the reasons that there's still some anger is he couldn't have picked a worse time to do it. If he had done that in March.
No, I totally understand. But you know, look, I mean, you hear all the time about people that get blown out of a job, like, you know, 2 weeks after they found out they're having their first kid, and yada. Yep. I mean, that's business, man, right?
I understand. Yep.
I get it, though. It did screw him. But it screwed him. But at the same time, like 7 years later, when it's like, well, but they don't have Andrew Luck. I mean, it, you know, look, the NFL.
That's gone.
Yeah.
That crutch is gone. And I'll tell you, though, one thing I just couldn't help but think about, and I have over the years, is what if? I mean, we could drive our – can you? He's 34. He'd be in his 12th season. Can you allow yourself to think about what this team might have done had he been able to play at the 2018 level, comeback player of the year and all that? I mean, it's not crazy to think there would have been a Super Bowl in there.
Mike, it was 3 years ago before I finally quit thinking about what would happen if Jay Edwards and Calvert Chaney would have been on the same team in Indiana, right?
Right, and that's one of those. That's whoever thinks that, like me, get over it, man, because it didn't happen. It's not happening. And from talking to Luck, how clear he made it that night he knew he was done. There wasn't any hesitancy. The only thing that kept that door open, ajar, about him coming back was the owner, who kept hoping against hope. And I don't think it really permeated the organization. I really don't think Chris Ballard thought very long about, well, you know, we don't need to get a quarterback because maybe we get Luck back. I don't think that ever right. entered into his thinking. But I do think the owner kept hoping that because he went through the Manning years and he saw how Luck wasn't driven, but they were just wired differently. And when you've been around guys who will try to play, Tom Brady, for crying out loud, floated out there that he might want to come back and play.
I saw that, yep.
And I think that was BS, but that's Tom Brady and BS. But that's, you know, again, the main thing is that Luck knew at that time that and I can only imagine because he said it was inside torment. You know, he was tormented inside. So it was he knew it was the right move, but you can know it's the right thing to do and still it tears you up. And that's where he was. We could see it when we were in that press conference. But I just saw a guy who's very much at peace with what he did and with where he is. And God love him. He's into stage two or three of his life. And it's going to be a good life for Andrew Luck and his family.
If ifs and buts were candy and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas.
Very good. I have a Merry Christmas anyway, but it's more about grandkids than it is nuts and all that stuff. But you're right. You're right. So I got to quit thinking about what if because it's never going to happen. It just drives you crazy.
Chap, let me tell you, in conclusion, broke my heart on Patrol Live when the lady called and was upset with her cat, and so she had them take her cat away. Did you see that?
Yes. I swear to God, I'm going to get me an OPL shirt. Maybe I'll wear it after the Colts one day, and they're going to say, what's that? I said, it's on Patrol Live. What are you talking about? You're in a cave?
Good news is the police lieutenant took the cat and gave it a new home. So
there you go.
Probably
there's a lot of good people out there.
Probably did a good favor for the cat. All right, Chap, we enjoy the conversation as always. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. Be well, guys.
All right, Mike Chappell on the game.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
S-line. When it comes to the NFL draft, you and I could easily probably rattle off. How many names could you rattle off that are going to be in this draft without even looking?
I don't know. 10?
Yeah, 10, 15, right?
Yeah.
How about coming up with a synopsis, a breakdown, an evaluation, a crystal ball for 402 prospects? That would mean if I had to do that I would have started doing so in like 1999 to have it done by now. But that's actually the incredible work that is done by Dame Brugler, who comes up with The Beast. It is the ultimate guide for the NFL draft. You can find it at The Athletic, and Dane joins us now on the program. Dane, do you have writer's cramp?
Yeah, my wrist is feeling a little sore. It's probably not good for my eyes either that I'm just staring at my computer all day, watching tape, writing reports, doing all this stuff. But you know what? It takes a full year to really put this draft guide together. And it was a good week last week to be able to finally share it with everybody. And, you know, obviously a lot goes into it, more so. Even more than just the analysis and the tape study, but all the background information and talking with teams and getting all the pro day, NFL verified pro day information and all that goes into it that, you know, if it's going to be called The Beast, it better live up to it. That's kind of my motivation for it. So, and hopefully people think that's what I did this year.
And when you look back, when you started out the venture this year, Dame Brugler, did your opinions of this draft class change? And by that I mean, was there a position that you thought it was going to be really rich in, and then you thought, you know what, maybe it's not as deep as I thought, and vice versa, et cetera?
I think a lot of these positions lived up to it. Like looking back at my initial top 50 in August, so just based off of summer study and before the season even started, it was very offensive tackle heavy, and that's how we see this first round playing out. The wide receivers were very high, and that's how we feel, you know, three in the top 10 this year. Brock Bowers, obviously high. So I think honestly, a lot of what we thought has lived up to it up to this point. Always surprises. You know, Jaden Daniels at this time, 8 months ago, was a third, fourth round pick, and he turned himself into a first rounder, a potential number two overall player. You know, your surprise is all over the place. But for the most part, I think the positional depth and the positions we expected to go early, I think that's played out kind of how we thought based off of the initial tape study in the summer.
Dane Brugler, NFL draft analyst for The Athletic, is our guest. Dane, the name that has continually popped up in mock drafts across the country for the Colts at 15 has been Brock Bowers. Now, the last mock, and I could be wrong on this, but at least one of the most recent ones you did last month, you had him around the 10 to 12 range. I believe you had him 12th. Mm-hmm. Why has he been the player that, albeit at a position that is kind of a luxury at tight end, why does it feel like he has been the player that has been mocked later by so many? And is there actual substantive belief around the league that he could be there when the Colts select? Because I'm kind of on your camp. I feel like his value is going to be too much for somebody maybe a couple spots before Indianapolis.
Yeah, and I think that has been the big question. Where does he go in the top 15? It feels like he's going top 15. It's just a matter of, is it 10 to the Jets, 12 Broncos? Does he make it to 15 in the Colts? I think when you know, people that get so focused on the T and the E, the tight end, just they're so focused on, oh, we can find a tight end later, or, you know, are we really going to draft a tight end when the track record of the position in the top 15 isn't great? When you focus just on the T and the E, I understand why people aren't excited about drafting Brock Bowers early, but focus on the tape, focus on what the impact that he makes on offense. And if you believe in the offensive play calling system that you have in place, I mean, he has a chance to be a real home run pick because he's so dynamic and he's so versatile. He can line up in line. He can line up in the slot. He can line up out wide. He can be in the backfield. I mean, he was taking jet sweeps at Georgia. He can do everything you want that you're going to ask a slot receiver to do, except he's going to give you more as a blocker. He can work the middle of the field better than slot receivers do. But he still has the vertical stretch where he can work the seam and do a lot of things that you're asking your slot receiver to do. So I think the argument is that, hey, I can find tight ends. I can find slot receivers. Those aren't quote-unquote premium positions. And there's truth to that statement. But, and especially when you draft Brock Bowers in the top half of round one, he'll enter the NFL as one of the highest paid tight ends at his position in the league. So I get the pushback, but when you focus on the impact he can make on your offense, again, if you trust your offensive coordinator, I mean, the value is outstanding. And I think 15 is probably his floor. I would have a hard time seeing him get past the Colts. Now, you know, we know Chris Ballard, the testing is important for the Colts and the way that Chris Ballard under his regime, how they've drafted. And we don't have any testing information for Brock Bowers. He, you know, he's banged up throughout the process, worked out at his pro day, but didn't do a 40-yard dash, didn't do any of the athletic testing drills. Does that play a part in all of this for the Colts? You know, time will tell, but I just have a hard time seeing the Jets, Broncos, and the Colts all passing on him.
Dane, did you ever have a situation where, I don't know, there's like a new sporting goods store in town and you go in, you're like, oh, you know what? I'm in the market for a new, you know, glove, a new baseball glove. You go in, then you walk out and somebody's like, you didn't buy a glove. And you're like, you know, they didn't have enough options for me, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you are an NFL general manager this year, what is the position that is your baseball glove in that scenario where you look at this draft and you go, I really need a guy at this position, but man, they just don't have a lot of options this year. What position?
I think, you know, after the linebacker group is not a particularly strong group. I really like Junior Colson out of Michigan. I think he'll be drafted somewhere in the top 40 picks, but then, you know, Adrian Cooper from A&M a little bit after that, but then we have a drop off. Now, Peyton Wilson from NC State's got a long list of injuries that's going to hurt him on draft weekend. The drop-off is pretty significant after that. I think it really – each position has kind of that plateau where it just falls off a little bit. You know, even a position like tight end, where Brock Bowers is going to be drafted somewhere in the top half of round one, but there's a plateau. And you're going to probably not feel comfortable about drafting another tight end until early third round, into the fourth. You know, that's where the value picks up again. But for most of these positions, nose tackle, especially if a team needs a nose tackle, good luck. This draft doesn't really have a ton of those. T'Vondre Sweat from Texas is the top guy, and you know, he's got his own set of issues off the field that probably knocks him out of the top 100 altogether. So if you're a team in desperate need of a nose tackle, this draft isn't going to help you a ton. You know, running back, if you're looking for a Bijan Robinson type of running back, this class doesn't have that. We might not see a running back drafted in the first 50 picks, which has only happened once before ever in the history of the draft. So, you know, this is a draft where running backs, linebackers, nose tackles, even maybe some of the safeties aren't, there's a few safeties that are, I think, future NFL starters, but overall it's not a particularly strong group. So those would be the positions where if you have a guy that you like a lot, you better come away from the draft with that guy, because the depth, there's just not many options at those positions.
Dane Brugler, NFL draft analyst for The Athletic, joins us. Dane, let's take away the conversation of Chris Ballard trading back, and let's say they stay at 15. I'm firmly in the camp of you supply your rookie quarterback, or de facto rookie quarterback, I guess, since he'll be a second-year player technically. You supply Anthony Richardson with as many weapons as possible to accelerate his development in year two. If the Colts are at 15, how difficult of a decision is it to go wide receiver versus cornerback based on who could be available there?
I think that is probably the same conversation that the Colts have been having internally in their war room as they stack their board, the vertical board, the horizontal board, because you're picking at a spot where you just don't know how those first 14 picks are going to play out. You know, they're doing their own mock drafts and try to piece together how they think it'll play out. And I think they probably look at it and say there's a good chance that Brian Thomas Jr., the wide receiver from LSU, or one of the top two corners with Terrion Arm from Alabama, Quinyon Mitchell, Toledo. And that's our assumption. Who knows? The Colts might have you know, different rankings within, you know, how they view these corners and receivers. But there's a good chance that one of those corners and a Brian Thomas would be there. And in that scenario, who do they like more? Do they want to go with – I think it's – it's always a smart thing to go with more help for your young quarterback, a guy like Brian Thomas who can stretch the field. He has X traits, which is hard to find. Going back to that last question, if you're looking for a true X wide receiver in this draft, if you can't get one of the top three guys, which, you know, I think a lot of teams would love to have Marvin Harrison Jr., Rome Odunze, or Malik Nabers in whatever order, but those guys are going to go off the board pretty quickly. If you can't get one of those three guys, Brian Thomas Jr. is one of the few that I think has those X traits that, you know, the team like the Colts could be looking for, someone on the outside that can help you in a lot of ways. But at the same time, they could also have one of these corners ranked a little bit higher, whether that's Quinyon Mitchell or Terrion Arnold, two guys that project as plug-and-play starters. So I think it's an interesting discussion, and I don't think it's necessarily a right or a wrong. It's more about preference. And you could argue that maybe – wide receiver stretches a little bit more in terms of the value in round two, round three, where you feel good about a Ricky Pearsall in round two, or a Brendan Rice from USC in round three, or, you know, whatever, however they have their order set up at receiver. And I think there's also something to be said about just drafting the best player in the first round. And if whoever has the highest grade at a position of need, that should be the pick. And, you know, it's hard to go wrong when you stick to your board and just draft the best player available. And I think ultimately that's what the Colts should do.
Dane Brugler is our guest. His work, The Beast, which is the most comprehensive evaluation that you're going to find of NFL draft prospects, is on The Athletic. It is out now. Dane, a guy with Indiana ties that I've seen yo-yo all up and down boards, and I want you to tell me, I guess the first would be where you think realistically he slots, and then the second being where he may still go, right, if somebody kind of jumps and goes out of line, and that's Michael Penix Jr.
Yeah, Michael Penix Jr. is there's no consensus. You know, throw the word consensus out whenever we talk about NFL draft prospects, and that's especially true with Michael Penix, who has so much talent. He is not afraid to attack every square inch of the field. I mean, he's a very aggressive thrower, has confidence in his arm, gives his guys a chance to make plays. You love the mental toughness that he brings, and I think that's something that will win over coaches in these meetings. The fact that coming back from four season-ending injuries, nobody wanted him after he left Indiana. I mean, he only had one Power 5 offer to transfer after he went into the portal, and that was Washington. And obviously we saw how the last 2 years played out. Now, I think there's also some glaring concerns with him. He's very inconsistent with several key areas of playing the position. His mechanics are kind of hit or miss with just the way his footwork works, his upper body mechanics as well, his passing anticipation, especially over the middle of the field, and then his overall just pressure reaction is very inconsistent. And, you know, he runs a 4.8 at the combine in a 40-yard dash or at his pro day. That's great, but really doesn't mean all that much considering you don't see that on film. It's not an area of his game that you really point to and say, okay, he can evade the rush, he can do this, he can do that. I think when you look at the college football playoffs, that's, I think, a perfect encapsulation of who Michael Penix is. Against Texas, against a very vanilla defense, he picked them apart. He knew exactly what was coming, and he was able to make plays. Against Michigan, he didn't know what was coming, and he looked lost. And obviously the final score reflects that. But in the NFL, he's going to see a lot more Michigans than he is Texas's. And so I think that's kind of where my hang-up is on Penix, why I gave him a late second-round grade. But at the end of the day, I think there's a good chance we see him come off the board late first, maybe a team trade back up into that first round to get him. He can start in the NFL, but can he be a top 12, top 15 NFL starter? That's where I kind of have some pushback, and that's why it'd be tough for me to draft him as early as the first round. But he's using the eye of the beholder, and I know he definitely has some fans around the league.
Dane, you mentioned Brian Thomas Jr. as a potential pick for the Colts at 15. Now that's about the area that he's been mocked towards. Depth at wide receiver is all that I've heard about this draft. And you mentioned as well that they could go potentially at a high-level corner, a set-it-and-forget-it starter right out of the gate there. If they were to choose either option, option A or option B, where are they more likely to find another, whether I guess it would be day two at this point, where are they likely to find another set-it-and-forget-it starter that maybe isn't projected that way right away, but if they give him that opportunity, he could rise to the occasion? Is that happening at wide receiver, or is that happening at corner if that's where you go day two?
To be completely honest, I think you could make the argument either way. I think wide receiver and corner are two of the deepest positions this year. We're going to see a couple of those guys in the first round, obviously, but then the position does stretch. So, you know, at wide receiver, like I mentioned, second round, you could target a Ricky Pearsall from Florida. If you wait till the third round, a Jalen Polk from Washington. But even into the fourth round, fifth round, a guy like Malik Washington for Virginia, or you know, Jalen McMillan, Washington. I mean, there's a lot of names here that I think would fit what the Colts want to be on offense. But also you can make that argument at corner, because obviously the top two guys, in my opinion, are plug-and-play guys. They are high-level starters, are a chance to be high-level starters with Terrion Arnold, Quinyon Mitchell. But even into the second round, I'm a big fan of Andrew Phillips from Kentucky. I think he's a really competitive player. Max Melton from Rutgers, DJ James Auburn. I think at the end of the day, it'll be easier to find contributing players at receiver than it is corner. But if they have a higher grade on, say, Brian Thomas, and they go that direction, say they just really want to help out the quarterback, I think they can still feel pretty good about the corner depth in second round, third round, and even into day three, that they'll be able to find somebody that, you know, they feel really good about. Obviously, you know, the 40-yard dash matters, the physical traits matter. You know, Max Melton from Rutgers, he has a lot of that 4.39 speed, a lot of the things that the Colts look for. Nehemiah Pritchett from Auburn, another one of those guys that fits the profile. So I think the corner class, even though maybe not quite as deep as receiver, it's still pretty deep, and a position this team, I think, will feel confident looking at if they need to later on.
Dane, I want to ask you about a couple of local schools, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We'll begin. I'll let you pick. Purdue, Indiana, your pick is which? I want to know the top prospect out of one of the schools. Which one you want to go with?
I mean, Purdue, Tyrone Tracy, he's one of my favorite mid-round guys this year. You know, we know his story. Started at Iowa as a receiver, moves to running back this past year at Purdue, and he's a guy that can help you in so many ways, catching the ball in the backfield, rushing, you know, even as a return man. He had a kick return touchdown this year. So he's a well-built kid, really tough to tackle, tough to get on the ground, really shifty. And I think it's all about what you can do in the passing game. That's what's going to be a big factor for him. Maybe not as an every down type of back, but you add him to a committee, third down back, he can really give you an extra extra element to your offense that you're looking for. Create some of those explosive plays, especially out of the backfield, catching the ball. That'll be his bread and butter. So I think for a team looking for that specific role, third round, fourth round, early fifth, somewhere in that late third to early fifth round range, I think is where we're going to see Tyrone Tracy come off the board.
Okay. Anybody for Indiana?
I mean, this year it's kind of light, right? I mean, who you think is the best Indiana prospect this year? Probably. I mean, I know they have the receivers, Deuce Carter, right? Or Deuce Carter, who, you know, not the biggest guy. The speed's okay, but, you know, he can go make plays. You know, Indiana, this is one of those years where hard to get super excited about the prospects this year. And I might not have a draft pick, but, you know, it's something that I don't know, maybe next year. I haven't looked at next year if it'll be better for them, but hard to get excited about Indiana's.
Well, there's probably a reason, Dane, that Indiana's been heavy in the portal, right? I mean, you know, trying to revamp with a new coach there. Okay, what about Notre Dame?
We got to start at the top, right, with Joe Alt. I mean, that's a lot of teams. They're not just the top tackle, but the top offensive lineman, period. You know, he's a little bit taller, I think, more ideally than what you want because some of the leverage issues. But he makes it work. You know, he moves like a much smaller guy. And there's a lot of optimism about just who he is now, but also what he's going to grow into. Because he's only been playing offensive tackle for 3-4 years. He grew up as a quarterback, tight end, didn't really move to offensive line until his senior year. So he was an athlete first. And now he's learning how to become an offensive lineman. And he's learned at an accelerated rate. So, Joe Alt, he'll be one of the first players drafted in the top 10 and another one of those plug and play, feel good about for the long term. That's why I have a hard time seeing him get past the Titans there at pick number 7.
And then you've got his teammate Blake Fisher going, you know, a couple rounds later, third round. So Notre Dame well represented there. I'm curious of this also. Dane Brugler, the Beast at The Athletic, is our guest. And you touched on it earlier, but I want to go back to it. I find this fascinating, the running back position. You know, the top running back you've got, I think, going in like late 2, early 3, somewhere in that round. Does that say more about Dane, the quality at the position, or simply the continued deprioritization of the position, even though it's become an important, you know, the receiving backs are important in today's NFL. But are we still seeing teams saying to themselves, look, I'm not spending first and second rounders on them?
No, I mean, I think it's more reflective of this particular draft class. I mean, just looking at last year, obviously we saw two guys go in the top 15 picks. And so I think teams, for the right dynamic talent, they see the value. It's just you better be a dynamic every down type of player, and you know, the Bijan Robinson, Jahmyr Gibbs, the guys we saw drafted early last year, they offered that, where they're going to add an explosive element to that offense. This year, this group, there are a lot of quality running backs, but none that have that maybe A plus trait. You know, they're all a bunch of B pluses. You know, they do a lot of things well, maybe not a complete back, maybe they're lacking in this area, but they're quality players. And so this is more, and this is, I think it's also a reason why we saw so many running backs get paid in free agency. It felt like the first day of free agency, the first 10 updates I saw were 8 of them were running backs being signed or, you know, just getting a contract. And I think teams looking at the draft class, that was a big part of that. So, you know, I think every year is going to be a little bit different. Teams look at the position like, okay, it's kind of deep in that third, fourth round range. But once you know, once that first guy goes, then you better make sure you have your guy, whether that's Jonathan Brooks from Texas or a lot of teams like Trey Benson from Florida State, Jalen Wright from Tennessee is in there. So all these guys offer something a little bit different, and I'll be interested to see how many actually end up going in the top 100. Is it, you know, I would put the over under at say six. I think there's a chance we could see as many as six go in that late two to throughout the third round. So we'll see a run on those guys. We just won't see, probably won't see any in the top 50.
Dane, are the conditions strong enough for there to be movement, high level movement on draft day inside the top 10?
Well, with the quarterbacks, I think so. And, you know, obviously we know the first pick's going to be Caleb Williams. He'll be a Chicago Bear. The Commanders certainly feel like they're dead set on taking a quarterback at two. We just don't know which one. I think it's fair to say Jaden Daniels, probably the leader in terms of the buzz that you hear around the league. But at number three, if I'm, say, the Vikings and I have picks 11 and 23, the first call I'm making is to the Vikings or to the Patriots at number three and see what it would cost to get up that far. If I can't make that happen, okay, then we're on the fourth quarterback watch. And could it be the Cardinals trading out at four? We've never seen quarterbacks go 1, 2, 3, 4 in a draft before. We could see history if that does happen. The Chargers at number five, they are more than willing to get out of there. So they'd be a potential trade spot. So, and then I think, so not just the quarterbacks, but then the wide receivers. You look at the Colts at 15, would they give up enough to go up and say to pick 9 or pick 8 if Aroma Dunze or one of these other receivers are still available? Is that a move that they would consider making? In my opinion, these top three receivers this year are legitimate number ones. I mean, they are worth trading up for. And I know for a fact I'm not the only one in the league that thinks that way. So a lot of teams, I think, will be examining their options if one of those three receivers does make it to pick 8, pick 9. And, you know, they have at least within a range of possibly trading up. You know, the Steelers, they traded away Deontay Johnson. They could be in the mix for one of these receivers. The Jaguars could be a potential, you know, after losing Calvin Ridley. The Colts, obviously, the Broncos. So a lot of teams could use that number one receiver. And I think we'll see, we'll be hearing a lot about the trade possibilities as we get closer to the draft.
Just out of curiosity, at the receiver, Dane, if the Colts, let's say the Colts wait and they don't move and the first three receivers are gone and they're sitting there at 15 and Brian Thomas of LSU is available, is that too big a reach at that spot or is he worthy at that spot?
On my top 100 board, Brian Thomas is ranked exactly there, number 15. So in my opinion, it's not. Now, I think it's important to separate inexperience from raw. I don't think he's a raw receiver. I just think he's inexperienced in a few areas. The route tree they had him run at LSU was more condensed. You know, a lot of slants, a lot of goes. I think he has the ability to do it. We just didn't see enough of it on film. So I think, you know, you look at the body type, 6'3", 210, had the best flying 20 in this draft at the combine. So that 20 to 40 range in the 40-yard dash. And that shows on film. When the ball's in the air, he just absolutely goes. And he can make those plays down the field. But he's also capable of more. So even though he's a young player, it might take a little bit of time. He's still just 21 years old. This is a pick that you're looking to develop with your quarterback, another young player. So getting these guys together, I think it does make a lot of sense. But again, maybe team him up with his former teammate at Florida with Ricky Pearsall. Maybe reunite those two guys together in the second round. Like, that'd be a lot of fun as well.
Okay, lastly, Dane, I'm curious. In terms of the beast, the first year that you did it, and I don't even necessarily, I mean, there might have been precursors before you were linked with The Athletic. The first year that you really went to this level in terms of your evaluation, you've been doing this for how long?
First one I ever did was my freshman year dorm room. It wasn't to this level, but the first one that I really went really, really deep was probably, we're over 10 years now, probably 2013, around there. That was kind of the first one where it's like, okay, yeah, there's more prospects than just, you know, the first 100, first 150. There are thousands of prospects that deserve due. And, you know, we need to make sure we're looking under every stone to make sure we're getting these guys exactly right. So, you know, it's grown every year because that's the goal. You want to be bigger and better every single year. But, yeah, we've been doing this for over a decade now where it's you know, a lot of growth, a lot of development, and you know, you try to get better, and that's you know, sometimes not easy with a condensed time frame. You know, we have to get it out before the draft, but you know, work hard at it. That's for sure.
Okay, so with that, the last question would be this: the biggest can't miss prospect that Dane Brugler has done from 2013 in his dorm to now is who?
Andrew, Andrew Luck. I mean, in 2012, he was the one where it was just, okay, everything this guy does is very natural. The movements, the throws, the way his mind worked, the way he processed. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't have to tell Colts. I don't have to sell Colts fans on how good Andrew Luck was. And you never use the words can't miss when you're evaluating a player, because there's just no such thing. But he was the closest thing to that. And maybe the closest thing to that in this year's draft is it might be Roma Dunze, because he's got everything you want. And it's kind of the total package as a receiver. And even if he's not the first receiver drafted, I think he might be the closest thing to a quote unquote can't miss in this draft.
Interesting. Interesting. All right, Dan, we appreciate it. Great work on the 402 different synopses, I guess would be the plural maybe, but obviously very thorough, and much appreciated the time today as well.
Anytime, guys. Take care.
All right, Dane Brugler from The Athletic.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between. Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.